Hello, Andrew Day.
What's up, Bob? How you doing?
Could be worse, could be worse. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Andrew Day, and together we put out the Friday issue of the Non-Zero newsletter called The Earthling, with the able assistance of Clark McGillis, our graphics czar, CZAR, title he demanded in really arduous negotiations that finally, brought him to our staff. This is Earthling Unplugged, right? But there's something different about this week's Earthling Unplugged, Andrew.
There is. We haven't actually written the Earthling yet. Not
Right.
all the way.
Not all the way. See, normally we tape this on Friday after we've just finished the Earthling. It's about to go out. We tape this. Now we're just heading into that dark 24-hour period where the pressure's on. We may crack under the pressure and there won't be an Earthling. Who knows? Anything could happen.
Right.
And so there's a lot of drama right now and we're feeling it. But there's another problem. You know what that is?
I don't know the
Okay.
other problem.
I'm here to help you understand what the problem is. The problem is, see, normally there's this festive air because we have finished the newsletter.
Right.
And we talk about the newsletter and I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that this time we're talking about a newsletter in formation, right? And who knows, the newsletter may not look exactly like what we talked about. Who knows? We're working well on net here. But that part's kind of interesting. What's troublesome is that I'm going to have trouble like maintaining this festive air that normally comes naturally. I've
Right.
got a solution. Do you know what the solution is?
I don't know that either,
When
no.
Bob needs a pick-me-up, what do?
Drink?
No, Bob doesn't drink. No, we talk about the JFK assassination.
Oh, great.
So maybe later in this podcast, if you will indulge me, right? We
For
could.
sure.
This is a recently acquired hobby of mine, spending time in JFK assassination rabbit hole. Endlessly fascinating. World's greatest rabbit hole. I don't even understand how the other rabbit holes think they're in the running. Whatever, this is
And
the best one.
the commenters want more, so they won't be
Some
disappointed. You've had
commenters
some
said they would
requests.
like, at least one commenter said they would like to hear more about the JFK assassination.
I think I saw two.
I have good news for both of them. It's coming. But first, we should say a few words about the Earthling, the Friday issue of the Non-Zero newsletter. What do we got for the folks this week, Andrew?
Well, one question I have is, do we know what the lead item is
We
at
do
this
not.
stage?
That's what I mean. It's in flux. There's drama. We don't know. Because, a number of the recent issues have been about Gaza or its kind of side effects, like the Red Sea thing with the Houthis. And it's not like that whole thing is getting any less consequential. If anything, it's getting more worrisome. It almost feels like we've said the main things one could say. I mean, it's like Biden seems frustratingly unwilling or unable to influence Israel's behavior meaningfully. He stumbled into this stupid war with the Houthis that's not going to solve the problem and is probably going to make things worse. We've explored the roots of the Houthi problem in last week's issue, which I thought was useful. We've explored the roots of the Hamas, of how Hamas kind of became what it is. We provide some good historical background. We've said a lot of stuff. And so I don't know. It's not like the lead has to make some original point or anything. Doesn't have to make an original contribution to the discourse. And truth be told, it's hard to make an original contribution to any discourse these days. But I don't know. We might lead with this, just a number of little developments on the AI front. What do you think? What are you voting for?
AI sounds good. There was definitely some interesting articles about AI and election misinformation related stuff. And we also have some Gaza war and more broadly Middle East updates this week that kind of continue some of the themes you just named. including the Biden administration's unwillingness to use its leverage to influence Israeli behavior. So we can start talking about that, too, if you want.
Sure. I mean, you know, right before we started recording, I saw a couple of things in the news that suggest that the Biden administration at least is starting to get a sense for the urgency of, like, winding this thing down.
Right.
I guess they're sending Bill Burns. I didn't even have a time to really read this Washington Post piece, but Bill Burns, head of the CIA, the person who many of us think should be the Secretary of State, is being dispatched on another mission, right, to try to, let me read a pair. I do have a paragraph in the piece, which I actually find a little, puzzling. It is, let's see. Oh, damn it. And I thought I had set this up so wonderfully. Okay. President Biden here plans to dispatch. This is a lead paragraph from the Washington Post. President Biden plans to dispatch CIA Director William J. Burns in the coming days to help broker an ambitious deal between Hamas and Israel that would involve, and this is what I don't understand, that would involve the release of all remaining hostages held in Gaza and the longest cessation of hostilities since the war began last year. Now, wait, if they want all the hostages released, I think they're going to have to do more than the longest cessation. I just don't see Hamas releasing all the hostages until you've got some kind of firm deal that ends the war without the leaders of Hamas getting killed, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't quite understand that wording. I hope it doesn't signify, though it could, that the Biden administration has a deeply unrealistic idea, about what the other side will accept.
What sort of thing would goad Hamas into releasing all of the hostages?
Well, I think, there has to be a complete on paper ending of the hostilities, I think, because they don't want to begin the hostilities again with the hostages are what make it so hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's the hostages are one of the things that make it so hard for Israel to do what it says it wants to do, quote, eliminate Hamas. Mm-hmm. It can't just go through and kill everybody in Hamas so long as the hostages are there. I assume that the leadership of Hamas has got some hostages nearby, right? And as a last gasp, security blanket.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an overly fluffy way to describe a situation when you're planning on making sure these civilians get killed, if you're about to get killed. But I got to assume that's what's going on. And I just don't understand why they would let go of all of that leverage without a guarantee that the threat of them getting killed is ending.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, it could be you could negotiate something that looks kind of like a loss for them, like they have to get exiled out of Gaza, conceivably, if they really feel they have a weak hand. But, I don't. The wording is slightly puzzling. But on the other hand, you know, this is one of those reports that's like, according to officials familiar with the matter. So they may have heard a couple of different things from a couple of different officials. I don't know if this is an intentional leak by the administration or they had to kind of glean the story from discussions with officials or what.
Right. Well, it is an update because previous reporting on possible ceasefire was mentioning some sort of like sequence where the elderly hostages would be released first and then women of a certain age and then men of a certain age and then male soldiers finally. And I assume each of those things was going to be accompanied by some new, you know, compromised position by Israel, like releasing Palestinian prisoners or something.
And I think that could be part of this. I just think Hamas, what I would imagine is that they would have an agreement on the first couple of segments of the deal. Okay, we release X, Israel does Y. We do this, Israel does this. And at that point, there's some significant number of hostages left. And they say, and hostilities remain ceased while we try to negotiate a final deal. That's the kind of thing I would imagine. And then if it all falls apart, Hamas is thinking, well, we've still got some hostages.
Right. And what about the other side of the equation, Israel's willingness to have a long-term ceasefire? Do you think any of this, or maybe do you think Biden's administration leaking that Burns is going to go over there and try to do this might be motivated by the ICJ releasing this preliminary ruling tomorrow about the South Africa genocide case?
Well, the timing is interesting. I'm not... it's not clear to me how this announcement might have a big impact on that. So the International Court of Justice is going to, they're not going to decide whether there has been genocide or is ongoing genocide or anything. It's a preliminary ruling that, as I understand it, will kind of either implicitly or explicitly say whether the court thinks the charges are at least plausible. So yeah. if they allow, I mean, they could just throw it out, which will mean they think it's implausible. But if the adjudicatory process is allowed to proceed, that'll mean they think there's at least some plausible merit to the charges. I don't know how explicitly they're going to say that. They may also order that things be done, I gather. The court may say Israel should do X, Y, and Z, or there should be, I don't know what is the range of things. There should be negotiations, but
I think those things were specified by South Africa, I believe. So yeah, tomorrow it's like the court is going to possibly release like the equivalent of a restraining order or like a temporary injunction, but without policing power. But the specific things that they would be asking Israel to do are specified, you know, by South Africa's case. And I think it's things ranging from stopping hostilities altogether or taking extra steps to let aid get to Gaza, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I think like Israel hasn't helped its case by with all this recent publicity about the fact that they're establishing a buffer zone.
Yeah.
Within Gaza. Because apparently that's of dubious or questionable legality in terms of international law, because they're destroying a bunch of residences, a bunch of homes. You know, by the way, with Gaza, like you do a kilometer wide buffer zone around the entire perimeter. That's like 10% of Gaza's entire land space, I think. It's like, you know, Gaza is, I think it's about 140 square miles or something. It's not big. And so anyway, that hasn't helped. I mean, that's how all those Israeli soldiers died. They were going to blow up this residence, and then I guess some Hamas militants attacked and more or less accidentally ignited the explosives that were set to blow up the house.
Right, and we're linking to the Wall Street Journal piece on this. And this is what I meant when I said there's more indications of the White House's unwillingness to use its leverage, because the White House has been opposing this idea. You know, the idea of this is not new. As I understand it, what's new about this reporting is learning, oh, they've been doing this like actively since November. And when Blinken was asked about it at a press conference, you know, he reiterated America's opposition to the idea of building this buffer zone along the border inside Gaza. But then he said, well, if it's temporary, you know, right, we can tolerate it then.
No, I've got the quote from, I think this is from the Wall Street Journal. He said, and this is something just drives me crazy. It is so typical. It's like, yes, we've expressed our outrage and disapproval. And like, well, is anything happening? I mean, we got a lot of leverage. We're supplying all the weapons and ammo and so on, and casting all the protective votes at the UN and XYZ. And here's, Blinken's quote is, we've been very clear about our opposition to the forced displacement of people. We've been very clear about maintaining, in effect, the territorial integrity of Gaza. He's talking about the buffer zone. And then next paragraph is, you know, but Blinken indicated Washington might accept a zone temporarily. Right. Like that's going to be temporary. He doesn't believe that.
Yeah.
He's just lying. He knows, I mean, it's not going to be temporary. Once it's there, it's going to stay there.
Right. Yeah. And as I understand it, the idea of it is that, you know, if Hamas sends fighters, Israel will always have a clear view. So it won't do anything to stop the rockets, because it's just like one extra kilometer. Yeah.
Well, but the other thing is, I suspect, I'd have to look at the geography, that along most of this border, you could put the buffer zone on the Israeli side or make it 50-50 without displacing a lot of Israeli buildings. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe some of it is agricultural land. I don't know. But I do know Israel has a lot more spare room than Gaza has. Of course, Israel thinks, look, Gaza started it. They're the ones who should suffer. But anyway, this doesn't help their case about genocide. Because, in fact, and we reported this in a previous issue, the head of Israel's intelligence ministry, which isn't the same as being head of the Mossad or anything, the ministry is not the agency, but it is a cabinet level position. And this woman was like basically describing, and this agency previously issued a report after October 7th recommending that they send all these people to Egypt. So this report advocated forced displacement, a war crime, basically. And, you know, it didn't have a lot of official weight, but it was a document somebody found and leaked. And more recently, this woman who's head of the intelligence ministry in the Knesset was describing like how bad conditions are going to be. She's like, after the war, she's like, look, there's not going to be jobs for these people. Half of the agricultural land is going to be consumed by this buffer zone, blah, blah, blah. So she has already put this very thing in the context of Gaza being rendered barely habitable by Israel's military action. And mm-hmm. I just, you know, can't, I assume South Africa is underscoring things like this in the court proceedings. But
yeah, it seems like most of their case has relied on public pronouncements from Israeli officials, which, you know, when you read them, they do seem quite genocidal. Israel has countered that those statements were not communicating information about Israel's plans, but kind of expressing anguish about October 7th.
Yeah.
It's almost like philosophy of language kind of defense. And so they're, as I understand it, they're releasing these or making, they're releasing these previously confidential documents to the court that show Netanyahu saying things like, we need to, respond favorably to America's request for aid to enter into Gaza, mm-hmm, stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I think as far as whether the court will just refuse to even, decide the matter of whether Israel is guilty of genocide, as I understand it, you can't just sue anybody at the International Court of Justice. You have to be involved in a dispute with them, or you have to go to that state first and try to get them to change their behavior. And if they don't, then go to the court. And I think Israel is saying South Africa hasn't made a real effort to do that. So I don't know how that'll impact the court's decision, but
I didn't know about that. But yeah, Israeli officials have said a lot of things they may wish now that they hadn't said, and some were connected to rendering life difficult, like the defense minister saying, we're cutting off whatever, the electricity to this. They're all animals. I don't think he confined that to Hamas at the time. There's a number of cabinet-level people who have said things that maybe they wish they hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's that. Now, this... the AI thing is, you know, we just had this primary in New Hampshire, and that featured a number of the kinds of things people have been talking about that AI is going to inject into politics, for better or worse, usually worse. I don't mean the net impact will necessarily be bad, but the things people have been talking about that showed up this time don't seem to been very heartening. I mean, there was a deep fake of Biden where mm-hmm. somebody did a robocall, sounded like Biden saying, don't vote, you know, wait, just wait till the general election. The assumption is that was meant to hold down turnout for Biden, which was turnout for a write-in vote because he wasn't on the ballot for complicated reasons. Anyway, there was a lot of publicity about that, so I doubt it wound up having much impact. He won.
I wonder if it helped him because the AI voice presumably sounded a lot more eloquent than Biden does.
Well, then it's a bad deep fake. It's supposed to sound exactly like him.
Right. And yeah, the idea he was like saying on the robocall, you know, wait until the general election to vote. You know, we don't, the Republicans want to divide the Democrats by having us have this primary. You don't fall for it. Wait until November.
It's a good line. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then one consequence of what presumably will become a proliferation of deep fakes is that it allows people to deny the reality of real video and audio. And you found this example, or you found this Post article where there was an example of Trump having done that a few weeks ago. I hadn't picked up on this.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because in 2016, if I read a Washington Post article about how Trump is ushering in a post-truth paradigm, and you know, we have to worry about misinformation and, you know, crack down on misinformation, I would have been very skeptical. I've always been very skeptical of that kind of thing. But in this era of AI, like, I totally believe it. Like, the Washington Post article is about precisely what you just said, how not only are AI generated, you know, political media appearing, but politicians are kind of using this like epistemic confusion about what's real and what's fake in the political arena to deny the authenticity of real videos. The most interesting example was Trump. Apparently Fox News aired this ad from that like Never Trumper group, Lincoln Project, that showed him, among other things, struggling to pronounce the word anonymous. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
it's a tough word. Give the guy a break, but go ahead.
So on his social media, Truth Social, you know, he dismissed the perverts and losers, as he called them, who were using AI to make him look bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I noticed on his Truth Social, he'll mention artificial intelligence. He'll say like artificial intelligence, parentheses, AI. Like, I get the sense that he wants to kind of inform his fans about AI so that he can use this tactic more going forward.
Yeah.
But that's kind of speculative.
Don't you assume that that AI will become one of his boogeymen? It's like the coastal elites are trying to inflict AI on us, and it's gonna he's gotta come out. Has he come out as anti-AI? He's got anti-AI written all over him, right?
I don't know if he has like a articulated policy on it. I like what you said, like last time it was fake news, this time it's deep fake news that is, you know, attracting his ire. So
yeah, no, he was ahead of his time with the fake news thing, because now, as the Post piece notes, you know, a number of other politicians in other countries are like saying, "Ah, it's a deep fake. That's not me walking into that hotel room with a prostitute," you know.
Right. Which was literally another example, like that precise thing.
Yeah.
It was like a grainy video in some, I think, Asian country, and the politician said, "Oh, that's not real. That's a deep fake." I mean, what's interesting to me about this is, like, if we don't get a handle on this, it will be impossible eventually to know what's real and what's not when you're looking at something through your screen. And I've said this in the past, and I still think about it every now and then. I think that AI could, if we don't contain it, it could lead to a rise in localism, like people kind of tuning out on social media, like going to the town hall to actually listen to the politician.
Oh, because that's at least real.
Yeah.
Huh. Now that's interesting. Could it, I haven't thought about that. That's not a bad idea. You should lead a movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're in Asheville, North Carolina, right?
Yeah, there's a localist place, right? Culture here. Yeah.
Yeah, do it. And you're moving closer to downtown, right? Where the hippies are. Are the hippies down at downtown?
The hippies are all over. Yeah, the crystal stores are downtown.
The crystal stores. I'll be closer to those. That's why you're moving closer?
Yeah. Well, we're being drawn there. Like, by the crystals. It wasn't a conscious motivation.
The aura of the crystals is drawing you there?
Exactly.
Huh. I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think, well, maybe it'll be healthy if everybody just becomes skeptical of everything online, right?
Yeah.
But of course, that's not the way it'll work. The Trump people will still think whatever he says is true. Mm-hmm. And then it'll just give people more reason than ever to dismiss things that don't support their worldview. That's right. A fake. That's a deep fake. Now there was also this this bot, Dean.bot. This guy Dean Phillips, who's challenging Biden. He's a congressman. He's in Congress from Minnesota. There's a super PAC that tried to set up a bot that, you know, didn't pretend. I mean, it was upfront that it wasn't really him, but it's like, I'm the surrogate of him. You know, I'm the Dean bot, and I will talk as if I were Dean Phillips, and I will answer questions about my policies. Go ahead and come in. And it was based on OpenAI's GPT. That was the engine for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then OpenAI said, no, you can't do this. Now, here's the thing I found while looking in. I don't know if you noticed this, but the co-founder of the Super PAC that developed DeanBot is a former chief of staff of Sam Altman at OpenAI. Did you know that?
No, I think I focused more on Ackman's involvement than this guy.
And then Ackman, it was his super. He's the guy who gave $1 million to this Super PAC, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think it's the same Super PAC. Yeah, yes. And that coincided, by the way, with Dean Phillips erasing all the references to DEI on his website. Ackman gave him $1 million, and the diversity, equity, inclusion phrase per se disappeared. I don't think a lot of actual substantive content was deleted, but anyway, that's a tangent. So anyway, it's kind of ironic. And then they said, well, we'll just make it open. We'll use open source AI, but then that got stymied somehow. So I don't know. What strikes me is that, you know, OpenAI is, you know, we're going to try to keep this stuff out of politics. And so here we are banning this kind of thing. Well, this kind of thing isn't the insidious version of it.
Right.
If somebody wants to set up a bot, I mean, it's actually slightly complicated because a super PAC is supposed to have an arm's length relationship with the candidate. They're not supposed to consult with the candidate. So it may be hard for Dean Phillips to say, yes, I'm officially authorizing this bot if it's done by a super PAC. I don't know, even though he would be happy to authorize it. He knew about it. But that wrinkle aside, this is not a super insidious thing. And you're going to see it for sure. I mean, it's like you're going to, you know, tech support, customer service, and questions on a candidate's website are going to be answered. You know, it's all going to be done by AI. The line between the way it's already being done and AI is probably pretty blurry. So this is nothing. I mean, the insidious thing is when, you know, they deploy a bunch of bots that are like incognito. They you think they're real and regular people, but they're actually just very, either they know, you know, your hot buttons, or they know exactly the tricks of persuasion. And I would think this could become something that candidates are going to be putting a lot of R&D into, is trying to just shift opinion in key states on certain things or suppress turnout. And again, it's another thing that's going to make people wonder what's real and what's not, you know? And then there's the intermediate thing, which apparently Israel is doing, or at least pro-Israel institutions are doing, which I read about and will mention, which is the people online are real. They're out there defending, making Israel's case with respect to Gaza war. But AI is suggesting things for them to say.
Right.
So, I
didn't have a chance to read that piece, but that sounds interesting. So it's kind of like a distribution of talking points, but like really fine-grained ones.
Yeah, again, it's like, what's the line between that and what was already done? I mean, it may be more nuanced by virtue of AI. Like you may have the AI instantaneously going through the feed of the person you're talking to and deciding, well, with this kind of person who has tweeted these 900 things, what you want to say is this.
Right.
And with this person, because normally when you run into somebody on Twitter or Facebook and you start talking to them, you don't know much about them. But the AI, you know, may do a total diagnosis.
Yeah, this is another example of what I mean. People are going to, like, unless we figure out a way to solve this problem, people are going to start feeling like they have no idea if the person they're arguing with on Twitter is some bot or someone who is being told what to say by a bot.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a point will come when you just kind of assume that that's the case. I mean, already on Twitter, I don't use it very often. And so I'm always kind of mystified when I get these new followers. Like, what are they reacting to exactly? And when I look at them, they're clearly fake.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. No, I've got a thing where there's this one reply somebody made, comment somebody made on one of my dialogues. It was actually about the JFK assassination. The comment is like, I haven't seen a guest filibuster this badly since whatever. And like, people every day, somebody will like that. I mean, it's just totally receded into the murkiness of the archives. And yet, And then I realized what happened. Okay, here's what happened. And I'm reluctant to confess this. I know it doesn't reflect favorably on me. But so like the early on, somebody liked it. And it said, so-and-so liked this reply to you or whatever. And it shows a little icon of the person. Okay, it was a young woman. She wasn't wearing all that much. Okay, fine. I probably would have clicked on it anyway. Who knows? But I clicked on it and just to see the profile. Yeah. And it's like, oh, yeah, well, this seems like some kind of bullshit. It's like she wants to get me, you know, to some porn site or something. So I go back. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, a couple of days later happens again. And look, okay, I click. I'm curious. I don't go all the way to the porn site, okay? And then I realize, oh, shit, if I keep clicking, but it was already, the momentum was unstoppable. Every day, a scantily clad woman likes this thing, this tweet I was mentioned in.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
Weird.
So it's like, it's a single entity, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
Set up that if you got to clicking on it a couple of times, keep throwing him the bait.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, these are not real women.
Right. Yeah, I figured that. And I mean, apparently there's no easy solution to this because it's like every social media site. Elon Musk claims that organic traffic on Twitter is rising. I assume that means, you know, traffic that doesn't count stuff like this, but that's not my impression at all. The problem is getting worse.
Yeah, Twitter feels weird. It's like I was talking to somebody else who's has the same feeling that, like, what happened to all the people who hate me? Yeah, I'm not getting as much blowback for foreign policy stuff that should give me blowback on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think that is? They're just, it's not, well, being shown to people who disagree.
I've been tweeting a lot about Gaza, and it could be that, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are kind of pro-Israel, but actually don't feel that great about what's going on in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Kind of could be that. There are a few vocal people, some of whom I know, pro-Israel, out there, you know, fighting. They haven't happened to comment on my stuff, but I see them out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I you know, there is definitely certain kinds of people who have left Twitter. There's been a certain amount of desertion. So I don't know.
I did notice today, I went on Twitter just to see what are the Gaza updates, and I just like typed Israel, and everything was so critical of Israel. Even to the point of being kind of conspiratorial, where I was like, that's like too exaggerated. I don't think I saw a single pro-Israel thing scrolling for a long time.
Huh.
And yeah, maybe the people, well, I don't know. One, the blob is divided on the issue, so you might be used to getting all this blowback for your Russia tweets, and now it's like half of the blob now kind of agrees with you.
Now, the blob was 95% against me on Ukraine, and is like, I think there's a lot of division. I mean, I was listening to this pretty blobbish podcast that has like Corey Shockey from AEI, neocon place, although she's relatively moderate as AEI by AEI standards.
Mm.
Rosa Brooks, Ed Luce, David Rothkopf. None of them are happy with not just what's going on in Gaza, but with the Biden administration's failure to exert more leverage.
And with Russia, Ukraine, it became, it's like, so, like being very supportive of Ukraine was something that people could be proud of, like they're putting the Ukraine flag in their Twitter bio, and that's not really the case with Israel Palestine, you know, because maybe because of the generational effect, like younger people are so much more critical of Israel.
Well, I'm generational, but I think even like, again, kind of moderate pro-Israel people, it's like, you can't really applaud what's going on in Gaza at this point.
Right.
I mean, 25,000 people out of 2.2 million, that is the equivalent of killing like 4 million Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, proportionally. So, anyway, what else?
Maybe we can talk about the Stephen Walt thing. He had a piece in Foreign Policy in which he was looking at how Trump would be different from Biden on foreign policy. And he basically said they wouldn't be that different. I mean, his basic reasoning is like, Biden's not really that different from Trump, so Trump wouldn't be that different from Biden. And he looks at...
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.